Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to episode 21 of Why Food with me, your host, Patrick McAndrew. Each week I'm joined by a new guest who has made the transition from a previous career into the food industry. And the show is here to share inspiring stories of people who have restarted their careers and followed their passions into the world of food and wine. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by a very inspiring lady, Debbie Way Mullen, the founder of Way Kitchen and Copper Cow Coffee. Thanks for joining me on the show today, Debbie.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's we recently got put in touch with each other, and I was very inspired by your story and where you've come from with what you've developed with Way Kitchen and Copper Cow Coffee. Could you just give the listeners an understanding as to what those two businesses are?
Sure. So Way Pantry is a Vietnamese-inspired oil and vinegar line that is sold in Dean and DeLuca and Whole Foods and several other specialty grocery stores. And it's a shallot-infused oil, and it's a high-heat cooking oil. You can do any type of cooking with it. And then it's paired with a seasoned rice vinegar. So it's kind of a olive oil and balsamic type of pairing, but with the Vietnamese profile. And from that knowledge, I decided that I wanted to do a much kind of more accessible product line, but still an elevated Vietnamese concept. And I just recently launched a portable pour-over Vietnamese coffee line called Copper Cow Coffee. And it basically, you can make a fresh cup of Vietnamese coffee anywhere with all natural sustainable beans and a California sweetened condensed milk packet.
Yeah, and it looks beautiful. And I'm sure, I haven't had the pleasure of tasting it, but I'm sure it's delicious. And we're gonna get into that in a little while, talking about Copper Cow Coffee and how you circuitously kind of made your way to that business. But just to go back and touch on it, because I'm sure there is a reason as to why a lot of your products stem from Vietnam. You come from Vietnamese heritage.
Yes. So my mom is from Vietnam. She's from Saigon. She left in 75 as a refugee to the U.S. And here she met my father, who is a Jewish American man from Los Angeles. And we moved around the U.S., but I grew up mostly in California.
We must have been a pretty culturally diverse household. There's a restaurant in Williamsburg called, why is the name left me? Shalom Japan, it's called. And it's, a Japanese wife and a Jewish husband. And they make these Asian Jewish kind of inspired dishes. And the crossover. Was there any of that when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I would say that I'm really curious to try that restaurant.
Yeah.
I would say that tons of the food that we grew up eating was a mix of both, especially, you know, I think I grew up with, we would make, my mom loved to make masa ball soup that my grandmother taught us, but we would stuff it with pork and chives. So it'd be like a pork and chive meatball in the middle of a masa ball, which is not very kosher, but. And we would always finish it with some shallots, too, which is very typical with chicken soup. So that would be like a totally staple invention of my household growing
Pretty
up.
Pretty amazing, because the Shalom Japan obviously started in your kitchen before it ever came to Williamsburg.
Amazing.
And growing up, did you feel a connection and a tie to Vietnam? Understandably, when your parents are from that country, you know, you're aware of what the culture is. But did you get opportunities to go back and actually get your feet on the ground there in Vietnam and see what was going on in the country?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely always grew up with culturally a very Asian household. I'm very close with all of my aunts and uncles and my grandmother on my mother's side. So I was always really curious about Vietnam, and I got to go back with her when I was 16 years old and got to kind of see where she was from. And I would say that experience, and also just knowing kind of the path that all my mom and her 11 brothers and sisters all ended up being refugees in around the year of 75 to different countries during the war, and just kind of understanding I became really curious about economic development and kind of why Vietnam was in the place it was, and why my mother felt, she always talks about how her whole life she felt like she just wanted to leave Vietnam. She felt like there wasn't anything for her there. There weren't opportunities. There weren't places for her to kind of grow and prosper. And that was why she always fantasized about moving to the U.S. and finally had the chance when during the war.
So it was
interesting to go back and see kind of what the world was that she was talking about, and how it was a really difficult place to try to imagine prospering in business or otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. And from that young age, did you have thoughts that you wanted to be involved with the resurgence of Vietnam, that you wanted to be there and help? Because you talk about poverty alleviation. Was it generally tied into Vietnam, or was it just as a global aspect that you had aspirations to work with poverty alleviation on a global level?
I definitely think on a global level, Vietnam made it a very personal and specific example of it, I think, for me. But I was just definitely passionate in general about, obviously, it's wonderful, all the opportunities that my family and I have been given growing up in the U.S. I mean, I feel like I've been able to, through the support of very wonderful parents, my mother was the first person in her family to get to go to college when I was growing up, and I was able to, study these issues that I really cared about. First econ at Berkeley, and then urban planning at MIT. And so I just really wanted to try to have a multidisciplinary approach to poverty alleviation and work at places like the World Bank, which is where I had most of my career in my 20s.
Yeah, because just to touch on your education, it's a very interesting foundation in studying economics and urban planning, as you mentioned, at Berkeley, and then going on to, was it transportation development? Was that what you focused on when you were at MIT?
Yeah, city planning, transportation development.
And then, but during those times, you always had sought to bring it to other nations as opposed to focusing on that in the States, had you?
Right. I was always really interested in kind of getting to work in Asia again, or internationally in general, because I felt like that would be kind of the place that you could have the biggest impact of trying to help people improve their lives, especially through transportation development, as you see, especially in Asia, rapidly developing economies. So that's why I was there, and I was based in Asia for some time, too, working with governments to do infrastructure projects around transportation.
And can you just, because we had the opportunity to chat yesterday, and the World Bank is one of those organizations that, you know, is very present and active in the world, but kind of that organization that's there in the background, in the shadows, that you're kind of unaware as to what their impact is and where they lay.
Yeah.
And through talking to you, I understood that their focus was through poverty alleviation, but I was kind of unaware as to how they went about it. So when you, because, you know, your credentials are incredible with what you've achieved in your education and where you learned. But where did that take you then when you went to the World Bank?
So when I worked at the World Bank, I helped support loans. So the World Bank would, like an example would be, I think, is a rural road development loan that they gave to the Indian government. So the idea is that there's so many different ways that you can try to tackle poverty alleviation, either through job creation or through improved health services, improved education, lots of things you can do to try to help bring people out of poverty. And the way that I was really focused on when I was at the World Bank was through transportation, that if you have access to if you have accessible transportation to economic opportunities or any of these education, health opportunities, that you will be out, help be come out of poverty. And so I helped support loans. And this rural road development loan, for instance, was $1.5 billion. It was spread across 7 states in India. And they just supported and funded the development of rural roads to really detached communities in India, and then also helped provide support to mostly maintain roads at the community level.
And in the outlay of loans like that, is it the role of the World Bank to make sure that they're kind of implemented effectively, that money isn't squandered or wasted amongst regional departments or possible kind of overinflated contracts that are given for projects like that?
Definitely. There's a lot of oversight. I think that's a big reason why that's a big role that the World Bank plays, is to help try to have some more oversight and transparency. And then also, there were definitely instances of when there would be something like that happening. Because, I think that is just something that happens a lot when there's a lot of government money floating around. And I saw cases where a lot of money was suspended or the World Bank would pull out completely because of issues like that, and that is kind of like the biggest power they have, is they have all these resources, both money and technical assistance, and they will withdraw it if they do see something like that happening.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting organization. It's something that I was really, really happy to chat to you about, because when I started to looking at it, seeing how they're involved in poverty alleviation, but it's from a totally different aspect. And I suppose it's, like you said, it's such a massive organization. It's hard for them to really have such a true effect, because they're dealing with such bureaucratic matters that I'm sure even when you were there with ideas, it was very hard to get things passed instantly.
Yeah, that's something that was definitely such a hard part of working there for me, that did not, because even though, I was always so intellectually engaged in what I was doing, personality-wise and work-style-wise, it was just the complete opposite environment for me to work in. I felt like if I had an idea, it would take 10 months to even get it approved, let alone carry it out. And, when you talk about, when I can say these things really flippantly about something happened that looked shady, and then we pulled out, there was so many meetings, so much paperwork. It was this crazy, crazy boulder coming down the hill all the time that was impossible to really feel like you were having much impact on where it was going and what it was doing sometimes.
So how long did you work there in total?
I worked there for about 3 years. And before that, I was working at the Asia Foundation doing similar work based out of San Francisco.
Okay. And then during that time, was there frustration in, that you had studied so extensively on trying to be involved in poverty alleviation, but I suppose your feet wasn't necessarily on the ground and being there in touch with people and trying to help, but it was I suppose it appears that it was much more of an oversight role. So did you want to get more on the ground and get more involved as you started to ease out of that bureaucratic world?
Yeah, I wanted to, I think something that I thought a lot about was, governments are going to govern themselves how they want to, and the World Bank can, help aid that in some ways. But I think I left a lot of time thinking about the idea of people not just having technical access to things, but genuinely feeling empowered to be able to bring themselves out of poverty or take on opportunities, especially with economic development. And I kind of also took a step back and thought about how I didn't feel very empowered in my workspace, how I felt like I was spending all my time making sure that I was, doing all the right things for my career. And sometimes I felt like I wasn't even spending much time getting to spend doing the work that I wanted to do, and knew that I wanted to do something that where I had more agency in what I did, but still could somehow... I think with all the business ideas I had, I was trying to figure out if I could still somehow have an impact, maybe in the form of a supply chain to support people who are doing good work and providing economic opportunities to people that otherwise wouldn't have that.
And was your focus during that time, did it go back to your personal ties to Vietnam, or did it focus on Asia, or did it focus on general third world countries?
At first, when I first decided to kind of take hold of this business idea, I was more passionate about the idea of kind of stepping away from the international development world, and began to get very passionate about home cooking, and about how I think that home cooking in the U.S. is a great way for people to take control of their budget, take control of their health. And I just felt like Vietnamese food is this wonderful, wonderful, healthy, fresh cuisine that no one really feels like they have access to, but it's definitely growing in popularity. So I decided that this oil and vinegar line could be something that could potentially create like a new market for people to eat Vietnamese food at home, which I think is such a, I truly think that Vietnamese food is very accessible and healthy. But I definitely got really excited when I started thinking about the coffee line, because then it really has some potential for scale, in which case I was able to kind of look back and start to search at, like, well, is there sustainable coffee being grown in Vietnam? Because I know that Vietnam is the second largest coffee producer in the world, but I know most of it's made into instant coffee that's passed around in or distributed in Asia. So what is there high quality, all natural coffee that I could sell in the U.S.? And when I went to Vietnam, I found some really great suppliers by using like my both my family network and also my old professional network. And so that was when that kind of really took hold, was being able to support these like really amazing people that are trying to revolutionize agriculture in Vietnam, both environmentally and socially sustainably.
I really want to get into that more and talk about how that actually is achieved, you know, in going yeah. into a foreign country and researching and finding these quality products you want to bring to the West. But just before we get to that, I'm going to jump to a quick break, give a shout out to our advertisers, and then we're going to come back and talk about that more, Debbie.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Welcome back to Why Food. I'm here with Debbie Way Mullen, and we're talking about her most recent development in her entrepreneurship with Copper Cow Coffee. Debbie used to work for the World Bank and has very recently started this company, which is very innovative and very exciting. So we were just talking there before the break, Debbie, about how you went into Vietnam and you wanted to find sustainable coffee. And you just dropped a massive fact there that I didn't know, and that Vietnam is the second biggest producer of coffee in the world. So is this a recent twist where people are now starting to realize that they can produce higher quality coffee that will be appreciated around the world? Because I'm sure,
exactly.
as you mentioned, it's for a long time been focused on the instant coffee trade.
Right. And so there's been, like, for instance, I remember I even met, so basically there's a couple strands of coffee. There's Robusta and then there's Arabica coffee. And Robusta coffee is much more prominently grown in Vietnam. And it does have, there is also like high quality Robusta coffee that's grown there too. But now there's kind of an interest in growing Arabica coffee or just high end coffee in general. As if you go to even just large metropolis in Asia right now, there's a whole explosion of third wave coffee. All these really high end coffee shops where people are having everything cold brew, pour overs, espresso, all the types of coffee that wasn't really prevalent in a lot of these Asian cities. You can find them everywhere in Shanghai, Beijing. Japan has always had a pretty big coffee scene. But as this grows, including a big domestic market in Vietnam itself for high-end coffee has been growing. And so now we're able to go to farmers and tell them that, you know, if you pay more attention to the quality of the beans that you grow. And additionally, because what's fascinating about coffee is that, you know, there's no end to how deep you can go. It goes everywhere from the soil to the growing, to the washing, to the roasting, to the pour. You know, you can kind of, intersect any part of the supply chain and make big improvements in the coffee. And so you see people really getting involved all along. And we found this great company, this man that I met, he had a tech company that he sold that had supplied a lot of electronic devices to Best Buy. And he's Vietnamese, and he sold it about 6 years ago, and he's from the agricultural belt of Vietnam. And he decided that he wanted to go into agriculture, which is what he had grown up seeing and knowing. And he bought a lot of coffee farms, started working with a lot of farmer cooperatives, started a logistics company, started a chain of farm-to-table restaurants, and also bought a coffee chain. And it kind of has this whole idea of a whole sustainable ecosystem where consumers will finally be able to trace where their food comes from. And so he's our coffee supplier, and he's been amazing to work with. And we've gotten to meet a lot of the farmers and talk to them about how they are making the decisions to kind of change the way that they're growing coffee, because they know there's a market for a much higher priced product. And so it's been really cool to be part of supporting that, for farmers to feel empowered to change the way that they farm and also have access to a much bigger market, especially we're their first U.S. customer, which is really exciting.
Yeah, I'm sure they're very excited about that. And what led to you deciding to develop what you did with Copper Cow Coffee in developing portable pour overs as opposed to just importing Vietnamese coffee?
A couple things. One was that I was really interested, actually, about a year and a half ago when I first started wanting to do an elevated coffee concept, is that, you know, I've always been very excited about Vietnamese coffee. I always joke that it's the gateway coffee because it's so sweet and decadent that everybody would like to drink it. And I was thinking, you know, the only problem is that when you buy it, there's a lot of additives in it. And so it's hard to find like an actual genuinely high quality Vietnamese coffee. And so I wanted to do actually a cold brew Vietnamese coffee, a bottled beverage. And so I spent some time trying to develop that with manufacturing it in the U.S., but still had gone to Vietnam to look for the beans. But then they showed me this portable pour-over technology that they had just started using from Japan. And I was really blown away, especially knowing that right now what's just kind of trending is the pour-over culture of coffee. And that's actually the way that I grew up drinking coffee, was with the pour-over. And so I thought it would be a really fun way, especially knowing that condensed milk is shelf-stable. So I could manufacture a single serving of that, and suddenly you have this portable pour-over kit of Vietnamese coffee. So you have your coffee, milk, sugar, all in one that you could have anywhere. You could take it camping, have it in a hotel room. And I just thought it became really exciting. And I ended up meeting this girl who came on board to my company who was also an MIT grad, and she had been working for Phil's Coffee, who's famous for their pour-overs, and she was really excited about it. And so it just kind of took hold, and we ended up winning an award at the Fancy Food Show, and we've had a really big response for it since we launched in January.
Yeah, it's a fantastic idea because it really gives pour-over coffee a much more approachable approach, I suppose, because you have it there in a packet, and like you said, you can take it when you're traveling, especially for people now that have had a taste for good quality coffee. It's pretty much impossible to go back to instant coffee, and I'm sure office culture is changing, that seeing the Maxwell House on the counter is no longer acceptable. You want something of a bit higher quality, so it's a product that I'm sure will be seen in offices going into the future, because it's delicious. And I can, on the topic of condensed milk, I can tell you I fell in love with condensed milk at Christmas because we made banoffee pie as a dessert for Christmas, where we just got two cans of condensed milk, threw them in boiling water for 2 hours, and then they turned into this beautiful, beautiful caramel, which we just spread over it.
Oh, yeah. I've heard about doing that. I've never done that before. That's good to know that it was that good.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's like you said, just like the coffee, it's very decadent, but it is delicious. And it's a really simple dessert if you're going to make banoffee pie out of it. But I think pouring that kind of caramel into a coffee would just be a little bit too much.
Might be good. We've actually talked about doing that. We're like, what if we were talking about something that'd be fun is to also do a Vietnamese coffee pour over flight. you know, and have lots of different flavors that you have in a whole pack. So you could have like a whole, we would call it like a Vietnamese pour over flight.
Well, here we
have
go.
Like a caramel and a mint and all these different flavors.
That's a possibility. And, you know, you must be so proud because with the vinegar and the oil and now with the coffee, have you started to see the kind of jobs that you've been able to give or the opportunities that you've been able to give to people back in Vietnam through your businesses that you've set up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been really incredible being part of, because they were really scared to tell us the price of the coffee that was going to, because you can get really inexpensive coffee in Vietnam. Like I said, it's literally the biggest, second biggest producer in the world. But I think it was just really hard to find someone that you could really trust in the consistency of it being completely all natural and high quality coffee. And it's really great that we are able to, that we're able to support it through, you know, we make sure that we have really beautiful packaging so people know how much care we take into with our products. And we know, now I've gotten to know kind of the network of stores that would be willing to buy this kind of product. So it's great to feel like we can support that price point so that farmers can get the right wage and have the proper practices. And also that we can support our supplier for all the effort that they put into managing that supply chain. So that's been really great.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. It's wonderful, you know, that you, because, you know, it's been a pleasure having so many wonderful people on this show. And the kind of through line that runs with so many people is that they've had opportunities to stay in jobs that are comfortable, where they make a good wage and a good living, but they've taken themselves out of that comfort zone because they had something burning inside of them that they wanted to achieve, or there was an existential kind of outlay that they wanted to chase. And that's a really admirable thing. And especially from you, you know, the World Bank is a massive organization, and I'm sure life was pretty comfortable while you were with them, but you took yourself away from that hub to chase something and to chase your dream. So congratulations to you with that, Debbie. And I'm really excited to see what's going to be happening with Copper Cow Coffee.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's been a real amazing journey to be able to do that. Because, I mean, even though I do think that the work that the World Bank does is very important and the hardest job in the world, sometimes I would go to sleep at night, you know, feeling like it's going to get done in basically the same way, regardless of whether I'm there. But it is a great feeling knowing that, you know, we're the first people to support and bring sustainable Vietnamese coffee to the U.S. market, and for people to understand what that is. And that I do think it's kind of fun to feel like I am kind of the best person to do that. I do think it wouldn't happen anytime soon if I wasn't the person pioneering that. And it's a really fun feeling.
And if people want to get more information on your company with the oil and vinegar line and with Copper Cow Coffee, where can they go to get that?
So you can go to either of the company's websites. One of them is just weipantry.com, weipantry.com, and you can buy online. Or we're also in lots of specialty retailers like Dean and DeLuca and Whole Foods and lots of other small, wonderful boutiques. And then for Copper Cow Coffee, we're still just getting onboarded into a lot of retailers right now. So the best place is to pre-order right now online at coppercowcoffee.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me on the show, Debbie, and hopefully we'll have you back on in the future and discussing the great expansion of Copper Cow Coffee.
I hope so too.
Have a wonderful day. Thank you. I want to say a massive thanks to Heritage Radio as well for giving Why Food and 33 other shows a platform for conversation and community outside of the mainstream. Also, a great thanks to the wonderful David Tadashore for producing today's show. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and subscribe to the show. That small action has a huge reaction on the show's popularity. And thank you so much to you for listening to today's show. If you ever want to get in touch, please email me at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org or on Instagram at whyfoodpodcast. I'm going to be taking a little break for 2 weeks, and then we'll be back with our third season at the start of May. So I look forward to rejoining you all back then. Thanks very much, guys. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.